episode of the Rule of Three. I'm Brian Lauren. Across the way, we've got Tim Slagle.
Hey.
It's two comics, three topics, 10 minutes each. The perfect podcast for your modern lifestyle. How's it going, Tim?
I'm doing okay. It's July. Nothing's going on.
I was just thinking about how wonderful the nothingness of July was. I didn't really have a, you know, I had an uneventful weekend that was nice.
I wish I could. I could enjoy it. But we're going to be talking about what you did this weekend later in the.
Yeah, or didn't. Yes, yes. And also what some people didn't do, which was continue living. Sort of our segue there. lost a couple of a pop culture great or two, I would say. So we'll talk about them in the next segment. But first, speaking of pop culture, I wouldn't say great exactly. but a pseudo neighbor of yours, you know, he's a Chicagoan.
Sure. It's
and in fact, he used to go to my gym. R. Kelly is back in the news. And, you know, you see R. Kelly in news, you know, it's not a good sign.
I want to go back to the gym. It was actually the same facility, not just the same chain, the same actual facility. Art Kelly would show up from time
Absolutely.
To time. Would you see him?
He used to. Well, I didn't go to the gym very much. I saw him once, but other people saw him more often than I did. I was not the physical specimen that you know now. I was more of a relentless beer drinker in college. When I went to Chicago, we had access to the Ray Meyer Fitness Center, which was a really nice, big, fancy gym that you got access to at DePaul. Or if you were a local Lincoln Park celebrity, you could pay a whole boatload of money and use it as well. And in retrospect, of course, it makes perfect sense why R. Kelly would decide to work out at a college gym. but this was right around the time that the famous P video came out. And you know, Chappelle would go on to make a pretty funny whole sketch about it. But at the time, one of the jokes that people like to do is a three-level gym, and R. Kelly would be running on the treadmills on, like, the second or third floor, and people would stand under the treadmills and pretend to get peed on the first floor.
And those were the days before there was cameras though on every phone, so you couldn't really take a picture of it, then Photoshop it, and then put it on Facebook. In those days, I'm sure that would have been a very popular Photoshop to put on your.
That would have been a meme of sorts. I think. Yes.
Yep.
Yeah, because this would have been 2001 or maybe early 2002. So yeah, quite a while ago. I didn't even have a cell phone.
Wow.
I would imagine. R. Kelly definitely had a video camera because
I'm sure it was a big one.
It probably sat around his entire shoulder. R. Kelly did have a video camera because, I never saw them myself, but, some friends of mine did and assured me that he was indeed in the creepy sex tape. And then also R. Kelly people, I think forget. Was married to the singer Aaliyah, who died. I believe he married her when she was 15. He's a legendary creep.
Not sure. No, I know he's a legendary creep. I don't know. Yeah. I don't know a lot about R. Kelly. That's why I wanted you to lead this one off.
Yes. We have a new. So he's back in the news, and it's one of those headlines that's both totally shocking and you're just like, well, yep. headline, R. Kelly allegedly keeping young women in sex cult.
Sure.
Sex cult.
Well, here's one thing that I've just come to realize in the past couple years is that God, if God really speaks to these cult leaders, God has some weird ideas. Because
absolutely.
Because it has occurred to me that the first thing that God says to a leader, one of the first things he says is that you need to have relations with all the 13-year-old girls.
Yeah, it's like, really, I don't even think they should call them sex cults. They should just call them cults, because all cults become sex cults.
Yeah. Yeah, that is the first thing God says to these cult leaders. It's just amazing the consistency. the God doesn't say, you know, you need to build a hospital or you need to open a food pantry. It's like, no, take all the good looking 13-year-old girls into your bedroom.
You know what? Maybe that's why we're so appalled by Scientology. It's the only cult that's ever been based on money rather than sex. It's just so alien to us. Like, oh, you're not even boning? You're just making money?
There you go. There's more proof that Scientology was created by aliens.
Yeah, you're right. Anything created by a man always comes back to sex, but Scientology, it does not seem to. Yeah, that is really strange. Yeah, you're right, though. There's no, so maybe give R. Kelly a little credit for skipping the middleman, because I don't think he had an intermediary step in his cult. I think it was pretty much, hi, I'm R. Kelly. You want to sing and have sex? And they're like, yeah. It's tricky.
Corey, I play, Feldman, am I got my Corey's right?
That's a Corey?
The singer? I confuse my Corey's and my Kevin's a lot. But Corey Feldman, he's the one that's got the band now, right? Lingerie Angels. He's got one too. He essentially what he does, he claims he's opened a shelter that his band is away for young girls that he finds on Hollywood Boulevard to rehabilitate themselves.
Yeah, they're all like runaways or something. It's super creepy.
Yeah, so it's so I could actually see maybe it'd be like an NFL draft day is Corey Feldman and Art Kelly doing picks.
A fantasy league ? Yeah, that's because like with the Corey Feldman thing, I was certainly hoping that it was more just like, oh, I hope those girls are just like punching a clock, you know, like the sheepdog in the Warner Brothers cartoon, you know, but that was just like a bottom of the barrel lingerie model gig. But he's like, oh no, we all live together. It's like, oh no.
Okay, let's stop right there. It's like that scene in the Michael Jackson Oprah Winfrey interview. Where he turns on the light and there's a round bed outside the studio, and says, "This is where I take all the beautiful little boys."
Oh, gee.
Oprah's trying to. It's like, oh, you mean it's because they're incapacitated and this way they can see you perform? No, sometimes I lie in there with them.
Yeah, people tried so hard to overlook that.
Oh, I caught it.
A little bit about the R. Kelly sex cult before we get run out of time, though. Apparently he's got separate Atlanta and Chicago. You could go visit the R. Kelly sex cult. You could join the R. Kelly sex cult potentially or apply. He controls every aspect of their life. It's all these women who came to be singers. And then he just sort of doesn't let them have contact.
Just like Corey Feldman.
No, it is. They're actually all exactly musicians. That's what I was going to say. It's very much like that.
So they come to be singers and they say, well, you know, we don't really need it. We're not hiring singers right now. However.
I think he says that, you know, because he's famously, you know, produced a lot of records and I think slept with a lot of people he's produced records with. So it's not even, unfortunately, his creepy cult. He has a couple of examples he can use that look plausible, you know. It's like a rigged contest that gave away two prizes. So it's like, well, we did technically two people did win. So their parents, and because these women and their parents and friends are like reporting them missing because they're just like off the grid for. I mean, some of this has been going on for apparently like over at least a year, multiple years perhaps.
Wow. Wow.
So that's almost went
on longer than his closet video.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean this guy is just a creep that keeps on giving. It's unbelievable. But it's interesting, you know what's interesting and the kind of a topic interesting to me is his songs, the nature of his sort of R&B songs are almost mind control themselves, right? It's all about getting you to surrender and you know,
believing
it's almost like a cult leader.
Believing you can fly?
Yeah. Kind of. I mean, if you
kind of like Peter Pan. That's kind of Peter Panish.
Yeah, I mean, just something about them is like, you know, the kind of the nature of that art, that particular blend of R&B is like, it's all about trying to get your pants off anyway. He's just sort of taken it to this like astonishing extreme. So, yeah, watch out for R. Kelly and Corey Feldman. Public service announcement from the Rule of Three. And we'll be back for the next segment. And on the second segment of Rule of Three, or the final segment, we're going to get to a little... You know, I feel like if I say what it is, it's going to sound boring, so I'm not going to say what it is because it's going to be good.
But it's
how's that for a tease?
It's, as you said, it's a bucolic summer activity.
Yes, you know, we're doing a little death and a little sex cult, so we want to wrap it up on a nice sunny, shall I compare thee to a summer's day type moment. But two, you know, they were older fellas, but not that old necessarily. Two big pop culture losses, Martin Landau and George Romero.
Within minutes of each other.
Yeah, I mean, I was like on Twitter reading about one and the other one popped up. It was like, oh my gosh, that's terrible.
It's been the closest pair of deaths since the Fishers. Fisher Reynolds. Carrie Fisher and then Debbie Reynolds.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Yeah, those were.
That was like within.
Or remember when Michael Jackson died? Didn't somebody else die the same day and just got totally overlooked?
Yeah.
And it's funny this, I can't remember.
Yep.
Suzanne Summers?
No. No, she's still around. Something like that, yes. No, not... Something like that that just got totally overlooked.
It was a blonde, a pretty blonde lady.
Of course, my favorite was always Sammy Davis Jr. and Jim Henson. Which kind of pointed out the conspiracy that I've always suggested that Sammy Davis Jr. was indeed a Muppet.
That is a very weird dark joke. He did kind of move his head in that. Yeah, wow, that is.
It doesn't have the eyes on exactly right.
You have to ponder that. Holy
it's very,
smokes.
Very Muppet-like. Very, it would not. In fact,
wow.
Diminutive.
That is the best conspiracy theory I've ever heard. I feel like I have a bit of a connection. I have a literal connection to George Romero and a. Not literal. I wasn't physically connected to him, like, personally. But
Is it a part in your life?
Martin Landau was in two of my favorite movies of all time. He was in Ed Wood as Bela Lugosi. I think is probably his greatest performance.
Sure, that was a fantastic. Yeah,
a line I shan't repeat on this clean podcast. But my wife and I, no one give two blanks for Bela, is a line my wife and I repeat to each other anytime we feel disregarded. His Bela Lugosi is just the perfect, the absolute epitome of the embittered celebrity.
Sure.
You know, he's just so great in that movie. And if you haven't seen that movie, I highly suggest you see it. I think it was famous at the time, but it's kind of fallen into second tier status, and it's absolutely not. It's top notch movie.
Well, it was famous at the time only because Tim Burton was at his pinnacle, I think, at that point.
Yes, that was his. That was coming off of Batman and Beetlejuice and Pee Wee.
Right, and then he did that, and I think people kind of said, "What's wrong with?"
Well, it was nominated for several Oscars.
Sure. Well, yeah,
it did fairly well. Well, it was very critically well received.
It's the same because it's the same introspective look that La La Land had. It's you know, people in the industry are gonna love the film because it's so, you know, it's so backstage.
I would agree. In generally, I think that's true, but I actually disagree with Ed Wood. That movie is, in certain ways, an indictment of Hollywood. And I think that's one of the absolute most brilliant movies of the 90s. I think it's possibly the best thing Tim Burton ever did, which is saying something. I mean, you go back and rewatch that movie, it's mind-blowing. It's so,
yeah.
Everything about, because what it captures is amazing is that, like, he perfectly gets that, like, what made Ed Wood great was that Ed Wood loved movies.
Yeah.
And he had utterly no talent for it, but he loved movies. And I think shooting it in black and white probably kept it from being more popular, because it's funny, like back in the day, if a movie was in black and white, or if a movie had any subtitles at all, people would lose their minds. Like, I'm not gonna read this movie.
Right.
I was just thinking about that watching Game of Thrones last night. It's like the most popular show on TV has subtitles all the time.
Huh. For languages that don't exist.
Yes, exactly. But so check that one out. And also, I'm a huge fan, in terms of Landau, of Crimes and Misdemeanors, which I think is Woody Allen's absolute best movie.
Yep. Love both the films.
I mean, Crimes and Misdemeanors, to me, is funny Woody Allen and serious Woody Allen at their perfect synthesis.
Here's the sad thing, is I knew the name Martin Landau, and probably because the announcer on Mission Impossible would say it, and so it burned into my head.
Right.
Peter Graves, Martin Landau. It was always there, so it was always in my head. I had to Google it to see who he was. Strangely.
I knew he was an actor.
I knew he was in a lot of stuff. But I could not place him in my head. And I think the reason why is that he was such a fantastic actor that he didn't really stand out. It's go to Crimes and Misdemeanors, Alan Alda. You always recognize Alan Alda because Alan Alda is Alan Alda. And in fact, I think the character that he played in Crimes and Misdemeanors, I think Woody based on Alan Alda.
I think Alan Alda's in on the joke a little bit too.
Maybe.
Woody's definitely playing up Alan Alda's personal blowhard tendencies.
Yeah.
For sure.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. And it's I think Woody did that to Alan Alda because he got tired of being bugged by Alan Alda at the cocktail parties to be in one of his films. So anyway, but Martin Landau, in every film, everything he did was a little bit different. I didn't even remember that he was Bela Lugosi in Ed Wood. I knew he was in Ed Wood because they mentioned it, but I didn't remember that he was in Bela Lugosi.
He disappears into that role. He's fantastic.
Yeah. Yeah, it's you would think that actually whoever did that actually had that accent, that it was for real. It never broke. The character broke, which made it wonderful. You know, he'd get out of the coffin and then smirk, like, I can't believe I'm doing
it. Eddie, I need to rest, Eddie. I need my rest. He'd go shoot heroin in the car. Come, let me fight the octopus monster, Eddie. Oh, love that movie. I've seen that movie a lot of times. Like, it's tough to overstate.
Apparently.
Many times. But, pull the strings. That's what my wife and I always, that's the other, the, and that's actually just a quote from Bela from an Ed Wood movie that we always quote whenever someone's trying to manipulate a situation. Like, pull the strings. But real quick, I have a good George Romero story. George Romero once gave me, I won't give away the reaction. George Romero once caught me having spontaneous romance in a public place.
Wow.
I took a date to the Biograph Theater in Chicago where John Dillinger was shot.
Uh-huh.
A different day.
Uh-huh.
And we were at a George Romero film festival. And we were enjoying the films. And we were, you know, youthful. And at some point, it was noticed that people were so into the thing that the theater lobby and everything up part of the theater was really quite abandoned. And it was it was well attended, but everybody was so excited to be in there. And the movie had just started. And I don't remember whose idea it was, but we adjourned to a separate part of the theater, and fond memories were made.
How far this was? Use the baseball analogy. How far was this?
It was all the way.
It was a home run.
Yeah, a home run, baby.
George Romero caught you in midst of a home run.
Well. Not in midst. The operation was successful. The mission was possible to honor our friend Martin Landau. And the young lady was excusing herself from the, it was the women's restroom. And I was going to follow her out.
Oh my gosh. The story gets better and better.
And this, by the way, just to my own credit, was not a one-off lock. This was a true swinging door, you know.
Sure.
This required some skill.
Sure.
So so she exited and I exited quickly thereafter because the initial thought was that, like, we don't want to go out at the same time. But then as soon as I should have gone out first because as soon as she went out, I'm like, now, but I'm just a guy alone in a women's bathroom. I got to get the hell out of here.
Right.
I felt weird.
Right.
Now I felt weird. So I made a beeline for it out. And
well,
and
you wouldn't have to worry about that nowadays.
Yeah, different time.
Nowadays, so yeah, now you would just have to say, if somebody came in, you'd say, don't judge. Don't put me, yeah, don't put me like under your definition.
Yeah. Well, I'm not that masculine looking, so it, you know, it's quite, it's pull offable, unfortunately. But I walked past and Romero was standing out there and he was watching, you know, he was standing right by, just right by the door, and because he was waiting to go in to the thing, and he saw her come out, I guess, and he saw me, and he looked at me, and he did like a double take, like he just... Just a classic double take, huh? Whoa! And then he kind of looked at the store, and he looked at me, and I just kind of, I just kind of smiled and shrugged, like, "Hey, what are you gonna do?" And he just, he got a big grin on his face, and he just gave me two big thumbs up. So a super classic guy, and I met him later, and he refrained from mentioning that instance, but he was super polite. And quick plug before we go on this segment, I would recommend everybody, if you're a big Romero fan, read my friend Tony Williams' book on it. Google Tony Williams, George Romero. I would say it is the definitive analysis of George Romero's work. And on the final segment of Rule of Three, kind of a weird segue from George Romero to this bucolic summer topic. And yet, it is quite the bucolic summer day. I don't know about you here, but the sun is shining outside of my window here in Minneapolis.
It's beautiful. It's that deep blue sky. We've got that deep blue sky going back of the
yeah, it's great.
Back of the lovely, lovely green of the trees. That's what I'm seeing out the window. It's it is perfect summer.
Yes, and so the fast-talking young fella who once had relations in the Biograph Theater has aged into the old homeowner who was delighted to discover a month ago that I have a raspberry patch in my backyard.
That's right. When we were talking about this pre-show, it did not occur to me that you did not plant those, that you have not been – this is your first summer in the house, right?
Yeah, we moved in midway through the summer last year, but we were just so caught up in the interior and painting, and I did the kind of the minimum yard work, and I knew we had these bushes that had some raspberries on them, and every now and then I'd walk by and pluck one off, but I just didn't really pay that much attention to them, and I think it was kind of later in the season, and I was mowing earlier this year, and I was like, man, there's kind of a bunch of raspberries on those bushes, because I'd never had them. I didn't realize that raspberry bushes kind of inherently hide the fruit.
Yeah.
But the way the fruit grows is in those clusters, and then the leaves drape over them, and you start lifting those vines up.
And that's where the best ones are, in the shade. It's the ones in the sun tend to get kind of dried out, and the birds find them. And but the ones that are under, they're shaded, those are the big, ripe, juicy ones.
They get that kind of purplish color, you know, that dark purple.
When we got the house, that was the first thing I put down was raspberries because I've always loved raspberries in the backyard. To me, that is the taste of summer. It actually goes back even further. There used to be wild raspberries growing by the creek when I was growing up, and in the summer we used to go out into the woods and eat on our bikes and eat raspberries this time of year. So
it's funny for me. It was blackberries, but it was the same thing. My grandparents lived out in what was then just woods, and there was a train track, and the same thing. Got a little creek going through there, and there were just wild blackberries all over. And
well, yeah, so black raspberries. It's same thing.
Yeah, like so my grandpa would always sometimes like we would just casually, you know, be riding our bikes or sit playing. We'd go, let's go eat some blackberries, and then we'll go back to playing. But sometimes, you know, just to kind of get me off from under his feet, he just hand me a big, you know, 2 gallon ice cream bucket and say, "Why don't you go fill this up with blackberries and bring them back?" Yeah, okay, you know, it was always fun. You know, grandma would make a pie or a cobbler. It's a pretty sweet deal.
Wow,
pretty pleasant Midwestern upbringing there.
So you had a lot of raspberries off them shrubs.
I was getting at peak. I think we're just starting to decline a little bit in production. I was getting about a pint and a half a day.
Wow.
Which is not bad for in the city. You know, I mean,
that's fantastic.
So yeah, I don't have necessarily a ton of room, but they're growing up by the fence. And so what I've been doing is to promote, because now that I've realized it, and I realized, in fact, I think I mowed over a couple of early buds of future, you know, spreading bushes. I've kind of identified those. I've been throwing all the overripe berries to the sides, trying to promote the sideward growth and expansion of the raspberries.
Oh, you don't have to. You don't have to do that because they put out shoots underneath the ground.
Oh, so it doesn't really matter if you throw the seeds down.
Yeah, it doesn't matter if they reseed. They will put out, I forget what those are called, but they will put shoots out of the ground. Also, it's a 2-year process. The first year one, they put out green shoots, and then over the fall, those shoots become woody, and that those are the shoots that will produce fruit the next year. After that, they die.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Yeah.
So, they only produce fruit one time.
Yep. Each stalk, it's a first year green, second year wood, third year dead. So you want to trim those back because it encourages there's a blight that you can get that will actually kill your raspberries.
That makes sense. I did trim off all the dead ones. I just thought I didn't realize it was a cyclical thing. I thought a couple of them didn't make it. You know, whatever.
Nope. It's interesting.
I've been making jam. I've been making jam like a fiend.
Been jamming
so much. I've been jamming. I mean, I've probably made, oh man, I've been buying those little 4-ounce ball jars. I've probably made getting close to 20 of those things.
It is a perfect Christmas gift. I hate to sound all Hobby Lobby here, but
well, hey, we're talking about canon and jamming here. You know, you used to have dreadlocks. I used to bang in the Biograph Theater. Now we're just a couple old hens.
Yeah, we have
yard preserves.
We actually, we've been doing yard preserves for years, and it's a couple things I can. Have we talked about that I make maple syrup? Have I mentioned that on the podcast before?
We did a segment on maple syrup.
Okay. And we also have an apple.
I'm surprised I hadn't mentioned the raspberries to you because while I was picking them, I was thinking about your maple syrup while I was making my jam. I was like, oh, it's like Schlegel syrup.
I actually make a concoction because we also have an apple tree in the backyard. So I actually make a concoction where I mix the maple syrup with the apples into applesauce and can it. And it's I put it up as the entire summer. Because it's the sap from the spring mixed with the apples from the fall. So, and then I put the year on it. And I save one jar from every year, whether it's raspberries or blueberries, which is another thing I do, or applesauce. I put the year on it. So tomatoes, I've also canned tomatoes and peppers. And I put the year on it, and I put that on a special shelf. And it's kind of this is my life right here. This is the kind of like the Frank Sinatra song. Is that every year of my life is there on a shelf that I can open like vintage wine and relive the raspberries of 2001.
That's kind of great. So it's kind of like a trophy case of sorts, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, kind of like a photo album, kind of like a frontier photo album.
Now, I have not graduated up to straight canning yet. I've just, because we've been going through them so fast, and I've been giving them away, and Tim Harmson's already put in another order for it. It's quite good raspberry jam. But I've been a little gun shy of the actual canning process. Is it how difficult is it?
It's simple. It's basically you do probably exactly what you do. You mix the pectin and the sugar and the raspberries until it boils, right?
Yep. But I have a pectin-free jam recipe, by the way.
Yeah. Mm. Okay. And then then essentially all you do is you pour it into the jars, and then you have the lids, right?
Yep.
Yeah.
Well, I'm buying the canning jars. I'm just not actually going that final step and truly canning them.
Yeah. You just put it in a pan of water and then heat the water to boiling. And then screw on the caps, and then let them cool, and then it sucks down the cap, and it's really kind of neat. There's something really satisfying about hearing the cans pop in the kitchen as they finally cool, and that's all there is to that. Then you can put them up, and they're good. We just opened a 2005 a couple Sundays ago.
Wow,
And it, yeah, it was, we were a little concerned about it because it had separated from the jar. But it was 2 weeks ago. There's been no hospitalization, so it's fine. It actually did age. It's got an aged flavor to it that's not unpleasant.
Interesting. Because the canning thing that did make me nervous was that I know if you screw it up, you can get yourself sick.
Yeah, but you got those pops on the lids, and you just press it before you open it, and if it clicks, like a little clicker. It means it probably went bad, that the seal broke. But as long as it stays
down. But as long as it doesn't click?
As long as it stays down, it's fine, yeah.
Well, maybe I'll try a little of that. Maybe that'll be my project for the last batch of raspberries. I'll try to can some of that jam to keep around for a little bit.
Yeah, a little souvenir from the year. And like I said, also you can make jars and make the real little jars and then put some ribbons on them and just Christmas gifts for the wife to take to work. For people that she wouldn't normally buy stuff for, just to have something to give away. Always keep a couple on hand in case somebody brings something over the house that you can run downstairs, throw it in a gift bag, and it's always appreciated. People who do not can think it's a far more complex process than it actually is.
Yeah, because I'm almost there, minus the boiling part. That sounds doable, but because I was giving people jams and they were inordinately impressed. I'm thinking, I've got this down. It takes about 15 minutes now.
And I know what takes 10 minutes.
Very nice. It's the segment of the Rule of Three, so that'll be it for us this week. You can find this episode and all the previous episodes at brianmillercomedy.com. Repost them on my Facebook and Twitter.
Tim Slagle.com. Leave us some comments. Let us know what you think of the show.
And review.
Tell us what you'd like to hear, what you don't want to hear again. We want to know.
More canning talk? More sex cults? We could go either way.
And there's one in the can.
See you next week. Nice.